Good afternoon. Everybody's looking cheery out there today. It's the Sabbath day, and it's nice to be together as a church family. You know, if we wouldn't be called, what would you be doing today? Working. Yeah, I've always, you know, somebody told me before services that they talk to somebody and they view the Sabbath as a burden. I've never quite figured that out. I mean, what when you think of the innovation it was in the Exodus that a slave people were granted one day in seven to rest and refrain from work. I mean, giving a day off when they had been. I mean, it doesn't specifically say this, but no doubt they were working 24/7 in Egypt. So we've been talking in the Bible studies on the topic of light, and I'd like to continue that theme in the sermon, but in a different way. I mean, light and darkness are one of the big contrasts in life, but light has other functions as well. So the sermon today is based on two similar but distinctly different questions. And the two questions are, is light a source of life? Is light a source of life? And then there's a very similar question, but distinctly different. And this question is light the source of life? So, I mean, there's only one word of difference, but one uses the indefinite article and the other one the definite article. So stated another way, we might say, state the question in this way, is light a source, one of the sources of life, or is light the definitive source of life? And there's a lot of, you know, you can go and take a look at this whole discussion. I mean, light is definitely a source of life. I mean, that has been proven by science and, I mean, you're just by observation. I mean, if about the only thing that, quote-unquote, grows in the dark are mushrooms. I mean, you've heard the saying, they keep us in, treat us like mushrooms, and I won't repeat the rest because it's a little bit obscene. But even that, even mushrooms and things that we think grow in the dark, is connected back to life in some way, in light in some way. I mean, you look at the trees and the grass and all of the living things in that sense, gets its energy from the sun, lives from light, and obviously minerals in the soil as well. So light is definitely a source of life, but I'd like to begin the sermon today at the beginning, and then we'll go to the beginning, Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the waters. I mean, there's theological discussion on, you know, whether there was a gap between this first statement of the beginning and the creation that follows, and I think that's a plausible explanation. But notice in verse 3, then God said, let there be light. And there was light. God literally spoke into existence what we enjoy today as a source of life. But more than that, I mean, it's kind of nice to have light in the room. You ever notice that? You know, you go around in the dark and you trip over stuff. I mean, it's really not that convenient to be in the dark. I mean, and metaphorically speaking, we see that what God said here in the next verse, that it's good. I mean, light is associated with good. So we see here in verse 4, and God saw the light, that it was good. I mean, it's good to have light around. whether that is metaphorically or physically, it's a good thing to have light. And God divided the light from the darkness, and he called the light day, and the darkness he called night. So evening and the morning were the first day. So whatever the case may be between verse 1 and verse 3, it is pretty clear here that we're talking about, in this particular case, a 24-hour day, because he references specifically the period of one period of light and one period of darkness, which is morning and evening. So it's noteworthy to call to our attention the fact that in the context of this question of whether or not light is a source of life, that light was created first. I mean, before any of the other things. I mean, of course, then you have the sun and the moon being set in their place, and that's a whole different discussion. But I'd just like to focus our attention for a moment on the fact that foliage, trees, and all of those things came forward after the creation of light. And furthermore, all animal life. And man was created on the sixth day. That is subsequent to life. Now, if you begin to think about it, I mean, we say, well, okay, could I live without light? I mean, I've been, you know, you at least can live throughout the night. But during the day you have light. But what if it would be dark all the time? And I see people shaking their heads, say, it wouldn't be very good, okay? God said that the light was good. So, I mean, for a period of time, I suppose we could live, but we consume, in order to be able to live, we consume plants and animals either consume animals who consume plants, but ultimately it goes all the way back to the foliage and the plants that are grown by generating photosynthesis and growing stuff. So you can see the connection going right back to, and I find it interesting that you have a cohesive account here in Genesis. I mean, think about how simple life would be if we just believe what Genesis says. I mean, we wouldn't have to debate whether or not God exists and get into complicated arguments. I mean, it's pretty clear here. But this is, I mean, we've talked about the beginning. Here's the beginning from a creation or a recreation, whatever the case may be. Let's go over to John chapter 1 and take a look here. It's, again, I mean, the two places in the Bible where we have the phrase "in the beginning." And we're just going to take a little bit of a survey here on the topic of light in the Bible. I mean, by no means a all-inclusive account, but we'll take a look at a number of the relevant scriptures, all the while asking the question on whether or not light is the source of life. In the beginning, verse 1, was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. This is not only going back in time the farthest that the Bible does, but it's also an astonishing statement when you think about it. You know, you have this, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. Verse 3, all things were made through him. This Logos, the Word, made everything. And just to be sure we don't misunderstand or misconstrue what everything, that the word all, you know, the Bible does this a lot, you know, it restates things. All things were made through him. I mean, that's a definitive statement. But it basically states the reverse. And without him, nothing was made that was made. And in him was life. And the life was the light of men. So now it connects the light of men back to life. And the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not comprehend it. There was a man sent from God whose name was John. And this man came for a witness to bear witness of the light, that all through him might believe. So John the Baptist testified, as we know, 6 months ahead of the arrival of Jesus Christ on the scene. And his purpose was to bear witness of the light. And notice in verse 8, he was not the light. Even John even said that he was not the one to come, but rather the one to bear witness. He was not the light, but was sent to bear witness of that light. That was the true light, which gives light to every man who comes into the world. So we see here a connection between life and light. And now it comes down to, you go from the individual word, the personage that was with God, that was the giver of life, and the giver of light, and then it goes across and comes to individual men. It says here that the true light, which this word was, gives light to every man that comes into the world. So, I mean, that makes a pretty strong statement, I think, or a pretty strong argument for the fact that light is at least a source of life. Because light comes from the light and is given to every man individually. You know, we even use this as a manner of speaking, don't we? I mean, she lit up. I mean, that can mean anything from, you know, somebody getting really angry to lighting up in the romantic sense, to a whole host of things. I mean, it's interesting when you start thinking about, you know, how we use this terminology down through time, you know. And, you know, you look at a baby. I mean, we've just had 6 grandchildren running around and 2 one-year-olds. And, you know, even a one-year-old or even younger than that, I mean, you can see the light in their eyes. And when there is no once there is no light in the eyes, death. When light goes out, when the light goes out, I mean, we say that as well, there is no longer life. And, you know, you can tell a lot by looking people into their eyes and the light, if you will, in their eyes on their mental and physical health. I mean, if you ever noticed the pictures that we get from out-of-the-way places like Africa, where people are, you know, just under a lot of duress and in abject poverty and starvation, have you ever noticed how their eyes look? I mean, the eyes, I mean, there's still light there. But I don't know quite how to describe it. It's kind of like almost a dull light that you see because, I mean, their life is that hard. But there is a connection here, a very strong one, according to the Bible, because the true light, Jesus Christ, gives light to every man in the world, verse 10. And he was in the world, and the world was made through him, and the world did not know him. Continuing in verse 11, and he came to his own did not receive him. I mean, the hardest thing you can ever do is to try to enlighten those who really know you. I mean, it's much easier to go to the next town. I mean, if you have the ability to enlighten your own, then you're really on to something. I mean, it's the hardest thing to do. I mean, Jesus Christ came and they did not accept him, but as many as received him, there were some, but as many as received him, he gave the right to become children of God, even those who believe in his name, who were born not of blood, nor of the will of flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. And here we have the ultimate statement in this particular passage. And the Word became flesh and dwelled among us, and we beheld his glory as the glory of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. The Word that was with God is described as the light that came to be, as we will see in a minute, the light of the world. And by extension, I mean, we have everybody that is alive has, by extension, a little spark of that light. And you see that. If you've ever been bedside when somebody dies, the difference between life and death, even seconds apart, is a huge gulf. The light went out. And death is the absence of light. But is it, I mean, this is the big question, is it the ultimate source? Let's go over to Matthew chapter 4. It's a parallel scripture to what we just read here. Matthew chapter 4. I mean, there are so many different accounts of light in connection with Christ and his birth. For example, when, you know, if you read the account of his birth in Luke, it is at night, but the heavens were illuminated by the angelic host that sang the announcement of his coming. Look in Mark. Let's go back to Matthew. Matthew chapter 4. We have the account of Jesus Christ being tempted. And he went out into the wilderness and fasted for 40 days. I mean, that is a remarkable feat in itself. And after that, here in verse 12, we have Matthew's account of him starting his ministry. Now, when Jesus heard that John had been put in prison, he departed to Galilee, and leaving Nazareth, he came and dwelt in Capernaum, which is by the sea, in the region of Zebulun and Naphtali, that it may be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, "The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who sat in darkness saw a great light." I mean, this was a prophecy about Jesus Christ being the light of the world before he actually came to be the light of the world. But when he came, I mean, the whole region was astonished by him. Notice in verse 16, "Then the people who sat in darkness saw a great light, and upon those who sat in the region and shadow of death, light has dawned. From that time Jesus began to preach and say, 'Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand.'" So the light of the world came to the region as it was prophesied, and he began to enlighten them, pardon the pun, with respect to the kingdom of God and life to come. So we see that light connects back to the past and is part of the in part of the message, and connects to the future in which life eternal will abound. So we have this whole spectrum. I mean, the other thing you could say is you take a look at the Bible. In the very first thing that was created on the first day of creation was light. And then you go to the book of Revelation, which we will later in the sermon, and it's almost like, you know, there's light throughout the entirety of the Bible. The question is, you know, what is the function? Let's go over to John chapter 8. John chapter 8, we'll pick up a few more verses here. John chapter 8, Actually, if we look at the context here, I mean, it's interesting. We're talking about the woman that was caught in adultery and was brought to Jesus and said, the law says to stone her, what do you say? I always find this really interesting. They found a woman caught in adultery. I mean, all by herself, no less. Okay, she was caught in the very act, all by herself. I mean, the account here is just astonishing when you think about it. The hypocrisy about the whole thing. Verse 10. And when Jesus had raised himself up and saw no one but the woman, he said to her, "Woman, where are those accusers of yours? Has no one condemned you?" And she said, No, not one, Lord." And Jesus said to her, "Neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more." Then Jesus spoke to them again, saying, "I am the light of the world." I mean, it's interesting that this comes right on the heels of that particular account in which he extended mercy and enlightenment to a woman caught in adultery, and the statement and instruction was, "Go and sin no more." I mean, if we want to become enlightened, as we were looking at the study this morning, you go and sin no more. You actually act on the faith that you have been given and continue to add to it. You will become enlightened. And Jesus spoke to them again, saying, "I am the light of the world. He who follows me shall not walk in darkness, but have the light of life." So here we have, from Jesus Christ himself, the statement that there is a connection, that light is a source of life. And I think that is it spans the whole spectrum, right? Because light generates plants, which animals eat, which we in turn consume, or we eat the plants directly, and that gives us physical life. There is obviously also a spiritual connection. And we see here, as is, I guess, almost always the case, that there is always a physical and a spiritual correlation. So while Jesus Christ makes the connection here of the light of life, it can be connected both to the physical and the spiritual. He makes no distinction, and I think we make a mistake when we make distinctions, not to say that there aren't distinctions. I just think it is important for us to realize that we are dependent on life to live physically, just as much as we are dependent on light, or if you want to call it enlightenment, to live spiritually. And ultimately, ultimate life will be in inapproachable light, which we will read a little bit later when we live eternally. John chapter 9, just over a page. John chapter 9. Here we have a definitive statement again from Jesus Christ in verse 5, where he says, "As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." So what about the statement that we read John chapter 1, in which he said, I'll just turn back there and read it again. John chapter 1, in verse 9, it states, "That was the true light which gives light to every man who comes into the world." So if Jesus Christ is the light of the world, what about us? Let's go over to Matthew chapter 5 and review for a moment what Jesus said that the disciples and by extension all of us should be. Matthew chapter 5. Here we have the listing of the Beatitudes, or the beautiful attitudes, as some have called them. And then in verse 13, he says, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot." Verse 14, "You are the light of the world." Now, Jesus said that he is the light of the world. Here he says that you are the light of the world. So which is it? It's both. The expectation that we follow him and represent him in every respect, in being and in action, is depicted here in the fact that he says that we are lights. Notice he didn't say that you are to be like a light, but he said you are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. So if we think that we can live our lives in hiding and fulfill the requirement of being a light of the world, we are just mistaken. I mean, what tends to happen when we go into hiding is we darken, we pull back from being like Jesus Christ so that we do not become noticeable. You know, anybody in any century that lives like Jesus Christ is going to be radical. I mean, it is a radical lifestyle that will automatically set you apart. And he says that a city set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. So now let's just take a look at a couple of things that are mentioned here. It says that this light that we are to be is to give light to all who are in the house. So in the same way that Jesus Christ said that he would give light to every man, if I'm reading this correctly, it says that we are to give light to all who are around us in the house, in our community, in the space in which we live. Now think about the implications. I mean, we are to set an example, and I'm sure you've heard this, you know, light doesn't make any noise. I mean, have you ever heard the sound of light? You ever heard light talking to you? I mean, I guess you can say that light puts on a show, right? Because that's how we make movies, right? I mean, it's projecting light. But there's no soundtrack to light. But if I'm reading this correctly, we are, as Jesus Christ does, to give light to other people. And this, of course, can mean everything, and it certainly means an example, the differentiator as light is. But I think it also means that we are to illuminate them, to enlighten people. Now, this is very difficult as we have a perfect example. Jesus didn't have that much success in enlightening those in his house. They ignored him. They didn't accept him. They cast him out. I mean, I think we've probably had that experience as well. But that doesn't change the fact that did not stop Jesus Christ from being a light. And neither should it stop us either. And then in verse 16, if we just to comment a little bit on that, I mean, we don't have light right now. We got rain. But that's a second sermon. Maybe I need to change topic and go, is water a source of life? Verse 16 gets into the active part. I mean, first we have the being part. I mean, you are a light. And if we are a light, you go into the active part in verse 16, and it says, let your light so shine before men. Now, I'm always bothered by this troublesome little word called so. I mean, what would be wrong with just saying, let your light shine before men? I mean, it's one of these bothersome little words that modifies and says that there is a particular way in which we are to let our light shine. And a particular way in which we are to let our light shine is in such a manner that people would see it. So, I mean, there's no way to hide. But the other modifier is, and give glory to your Father in heaven. I mean, that's a really high standard. That's a really high standard. And it's interesting, I mean, if hold that thought, let's pop back to, stay right here for a moment, and continue into the next verse. I mean, I just said that this little, I mean, if it wouldn't be for that bothersome two-letter word, I mean, there are certain things about the Bible that they're just, it just would be easier if you cross some of the things out, you know. Just cross out the word so, and it would make it a lot easier. Just let your light shine and get rid of this bit about glorifying your Father in heaven. I mean, that would make it seem a lot more doable. But notice what the next verse is. Do not think that I came to destroy the laws and the prophet. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. Now let's hold that thought and go to Psalms 119. And see the connection here between law and light. Psalm 119, and we'll look at verse 105. There are a lot of verses here. Your word is a lamp to my feet. Your word. Think about what we just read in John. The written word of God is a lamp to, in this case, David's feet. But the incarnate word, Jesus Christ, was a literal light to the world. So you see the consistency between Old and New Testament. You know, we were reading about the Word, which was the second person of the Godhead, that became Jesus Christ. And here we have the written Word. Your Word is a lamp to my feet and a light to my path. So the idea of the law being light, illuminating, is not a New Testament concept. It was an Old Testament. In one sense, it was the fundamental purpose of the Torah, if you will, was to enlighten a world that was pantheistic and idolatrous and murderers and, you know, everything that you can imagine. I mean, we look back at the law, and a lot of this is Christianity's fault because we pardon the pun, they fault the law, and it's their fault. It's our fault. Maybe we should take responsibility in part as well, because, you know, we look back and you see statements like eye for an eye and tooth for a tooth, and, you know, any number of other things, but let's just stay with that. In that culture, limiting revenge, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, was actually and lightning. I mean, if you let human nature just have its course without any self-control, if somebody came and punched out the eye of your daughter, I mean, you can be pretty sure that most human, if you just let, well, let me give you an example. Let's think about the barbarous Germanic tribes in Germany in the Middle Ages. You do something to someone's daughter like that, I mean, it would cost a lot more than just, you know, eye for eye. So the law, even in its Old Testament form, was much more merciful than the cultures that were around at that time. But coming back to Matthew chapter 17, notice with respect to letting our light shine, Jesus Christ immediately ups the ante, if you will, in verse 18, "For assuredly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot or tittle will by no means pass from the law till all is fulfilled. Whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men to shall be called the least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I say to you, that unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." So if we go back to that little word, so, in this particular context, I mean, you look at the scribes and the Pharisees and all the rigors and rituals that they legalistically held to. Jesus Christ said that our righteousness has to exceed that. In order to be an illuminating light that will cause people to see and then praise our Father in heaven, glorify our Father in heaven. So, I mean, that's kind of an abstract philosophical context up until this point, but Jesus gets into the specifics. How is this done? "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not murder,' and 'Whoever murders shall be in danger of judgment. But I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother without cause shall be in danger of judgment.'" That's what we call the spirit of the law. So let's drop down to verse 27. "You have heard that it was said of old, 'You shall not commit adultery.'" I mean, this was the specific commandment protecting relationships and family. I mean, this was also from the Old Testament law. It's really, I've got competition. I mean, yeah, that's okay. Just look around for a minute. I mean, it's really coming down. It's very good for our corn crop. The farmers will love it. Okay, we'll get back to the sermon. "You have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you, whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Now, that takes it up a couple of notches. I mean, that is illuminating at a much different level. I was having a debate with some community folk with respect to, I mean, the letter of the law versus the spirit, you know, and the any time you go down this road of, okay, the letter, you know, the letter kills. I mean, that's true. But so we keep the spirit of the law. Oh, you do, right? Okay. So tell me about, give me an example, and I cited this. And I said, okay, so give me an example of how to keep the spirit of the law of adultery And what you're telling me is we don't have to keep the letter, right? Now, what red-blooded man wouldn't think that's a great idea, okay? I mean, when you get into discussions like this, you have to have practical examples to show why that is just not true. I cannot think of one instance where it's possible to keep the spirit of the law without by default also keeping the letter. And that, you know, it connects back to this word so. When we begin to do these things, we are exceeding the righteousness of the scribes and the Pharisees and being a light to those in our house. And to the extent that we don't do that, obviously we're casting a shadow across the room and bringing not glory. They will not glorify our Father in heaven, but rather do quite the opposite. So we come back to our question. If we, as Jesus Christ says here, that we are to be lights, I mean, that's to be our state of being, and as he says, we are to let our light so shine, that's the active part, in doing so, do we become the or a source of life? I mean, that's a challenging version of the question. I mean, would you go that far? That you're a giver of life? I mean, is that true? If light is somehow connected to life, if light gives life, and we are to let our light shine to those in a room, then, I mean, it logically follows that in some respect, we become a giver of life. And, you know, I see you become, you know, a little bit, you know, uncomfortable. That's okay. Just stay with me for the moment. And let's talk about what we say and what we do. I mean, have you ever heard the term? I mean, oh, she's the life of the party. Okay? I mean, we're talking about an individual who has the ability to bring, to animate stuff, to bring it to life. I mean, I had a good example of that yesterday. We went to the Age of Steam Museum, which, by the way, that's in Sugar Creek, and I had actually kind of given it up because they were having difficulty getting tickets, and then the question was, is this really something for 4-year-olds and 7-year-olds and all that kind of thing? Well, it ended up being a really good thing, and a lot of it came down to the individual that did the tour. He brought it to life and made it interesting. I mean, he hired the kids to be the engineer, the conductor, and all those things. So all of a sudden, looking at big chunks of iron and wheels and steam from 100 years ago became interesting. You see, individual human beings have the capacity to do that, to bring things to life. And that is something that Jesus Christ specifically commanded us to do. I mean, some personalities are more inclined to do that just naturally than others. But, you know, you may talk about the scale of introversion to extroversion. Of course, I'm a very introverted person. I know you all know that. Okay? I need my privacy, you know. And if you believe that, I have a bridge I'll sell you. Okay? And then there are individuals who need their privacy and are energized by being alone. Both ends of the spectrum can be a light. Because a light doesn't have to talk. I mean, nobody has to do what I'm doing just now, you know, trying to distract you from to keep your attention in competition with natural forces outside called rain. So I think it is accurate to say that to the extent that we follow Jesus Christ and are lights as he is light and shine lights as he shone light, that we become in a small way a giver of light, of life. And notice, is connecting back to a light, a source of life. And there's a reason why I asked those two different questions at the beginning, because, as we'll see in a moment, we'll go there right now, as time is running. And we asked the question, what then? I mean, if all of these things, I mean, Jesus Christ as the incarnate on earth was the light of the world, we are to be the light of the world, that would all go under the category of, is light a source of life? And the answer would be yes. And then you go by extension and you look at individual human beings just in our physical interaction. You know, you can bring things to life. And that as well is a source of life. Actually, when you get down to defining life, have you ever gone to a dictionary or a philosophical dictionary to get the definition of life? That's one of the things that men have a really hard time defining. What actually is life? I mean, there are different definitions, but they struggle with it. But yet we talk about these things. I mean, we can see life. I mean, the contrast between life and death is stark. But how you actually define it in all its dimensions is a very difficult thing to do. So let's take a look and go back to John chapter 1, verse 4 once again. And notice a little bit more closely what is stated in verse 4. Now, after verses 1 through 3, in which you have God and the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and you have all of that, verse 4 makes a definitive statement, and it says, in him was life. And the life, this referring specifically to him, and the life was the light of men. So what we see here, if we're reading this correctly, is that while light is connected and a source of life, the source of life rests in him. So while light is a source of life, and we see that, as we've already discussed, in the natural world and even in the spiritual world, the actual, the ultimate, the first cause, if you will, of life is God himself, in this case, in the personage of Jesus Christ. And this is an interesting question as well, because it, in verse 4 here, it makes a specific reference back to the Word, not specifically back to God the Father. So if Jesus Christ, the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ, the Word, is the actual, the definitive source of life, what about the Father? Let's go over to John chapter 5, Jesus Christ answered that question. John chapter 5, in verse 25, most assuredly I say to you, the hour is coming, and now is when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. I mean, here is a literal bringing back to life from the dead. And the question here is, what is the source? Is it light? Or is it something much more powerful? Notice, in verse 26, "For as the Father has life in himself, so he has granted to the Son to have life in himself." So both the Father and the Son, while one in mind and spirit, have the capacity to live individually, if you will, apart from each other, and that was very necessary with respect to the crucifixion. Because the life that died on the cross was God, otherwise it wouldn't have paid for the aggregate sins of all humanity. That's a different topic. So the answer to the question, is light the source of life, is a resounding no. It is a source of life, yes. In many different respects, including all the things that we experience and live by, down to, you know, the life of the party. And we talk about that in a manner of speaking, but we must never confuse that, as important as that is, with the real source of life, being God. Pre-incarnate, incarnate, and if I can make up the word post-incarnate after the resurrection. So let's go have a look at that over in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. First Corinthians chapter 15. You know, we read, as we should, all this stuff about the resurrection and the glorious body and all that, but you really should someday just sit down and read from verse 1 all the way to verse 58. Because, you know, Paul was a great scholar, and I mean, if you want to build a case of evidence for the resurrection, he's got all the goods right here. I mean, he makes the argument for and against the resurrection of Jesus Christ to life, because, you know, Jesus Christ had better have had life in himself and died, and the Father had better had life in himself and had the ability to bring Jesus Christ back to that same life, or we would all be doomed, as Paul puts very clearly in this chapter. He said, we of all men would be most miserable. But that's just an aside. It's important to read the entirety of the chapter, because, you know, when people poo-poo the resurrection, you know, it's just some fictitious, the disciples made that up. I mean, it's interesting, and at least in the reading that I've been doing over the last couple of years, atheistic historians today acknowledge that Jesus Christ lived, that story is true, and they also, for the most part, acknowledge that Jesus died on a cross. I mean, they feel it's historically viable account, and some of them, and these are people that don't believe in God, acknowledge that there was an empty tomb. Okay, and I find that to be quite interesting. And then you take that, and I'm kind of going on a digression here, so we'll get back to it here in a minute. But when you connect that back to the evidence that Paul cites, you know, often hallucination is cited as what probably happened. I mean, these disciples had risked their lives and put their businesses at stake and, you know, followed this would-be Messiah, and then he died. I mean, and they had post-traumatic stress syndrome and hallucinated. Okay, that's an argument, but 500 at the same time? I mean, that's never happened. Verse 45. "And so it is written, the first man, Adam, became a living being." So Adam was imbued with the breath of life and lived like as a man. I mean, he was the first man. And, you know, he, in his own way, I mean, he was made in the image of God. So he, along with Eve, one could argue, was the source of all life, humanly speaking. Because all peoples descended from them, so he, in that sense, was a source of life. And he was able to live because he ate vegetables that light had created. So you take it back to that question. The first man, Adam, became a living being. The last Adam became a life-giving spirit. So if we go back and you look at the steps here, you have the source of life. In John chapter 1, verse 4, where it says that in him was life, who became, in verse 14, incarnate, became flesh, and even as a fleshly human being, said that the Father had granted him authority to have life in himself. But then after this incarnate Christ was life in himself, died on the cross for your sins and mine, he once again became a life-giving spirit and went back to the glory that he had before the world was, as he prayed to his Father the night before his crucifixion. So while light is a source of life, the definitive source of life is none other than Jesus Christ and God the Father. It's a couple of other scriptures here, and then we'll wrap it up. John chapter 6. This is just a chapter beyond chapter 5 where Jesus makes the statement and the claim of having life in himself. And then we come down to verse 44, and here we see, again, the interaction between Jesus Christ and God the Father. I mean, we see different roles. We see that here in verse 44, it is the Father's role to call. That is a prerogative for which he has reserved the exclusive right to. No one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws him, and I will raise him up at the last day. Now, in order for those two things to happen, the Father and Jesus Christ have the ability to do different things, but to work in concert. And Jesus Christ is able to raise him up at the last day because the last Adam became a life-giving spirit, the ultimate source of all life in creation. I mean, everything we see here, I mean, it is held in place and doesn't go into chaos because it's all held in place with the source of life. And you notice, I mean, the whole chapter here, I mean, it talks about verse 48. He says, I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate manna in the wilderness and are dead. I mean, manna in that case was a source of life. I mean, and again, that goes back to the light portion of it. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I shall give is my flesh, which I shall give for the life of the world. So the distinction in one, I mean, the two questions seem so similar. But the difference between the two in the ultimate sense is very stark. Because it unequivocally makes God, and in this case Jesus Christ, the creator of all. And that is the big innovation of the Torah as well, the first, the Pentateuch, or the first five books of the Bible, depending, you know, whether you refer to it in the Hebrew, Greek, or English. The God of the Bible is revealed as the creator of nature and apart from it, as instead of a God in nature, which all the other gods were a part of. I mean, that's, I mean, down to the reality of making them out of wood and stone and gold, which, I mean, they thought was an image, of course, of the gods that were part of that particular culture. So the notion that there is a God that is, as they would say in philosophy, the first cause, that is completely apart from the creation that we are all a part of, was a really big idea as it is today. You know, when, you know, the question is often asked in debates, you know, well, you know, if God created everything, who created God? I mean, that question doesn't even, that's a stupid question to begin with, but it doesn't really even apply. Because the God of the Bible is the eternal God. He is the source of life. So to ask the question on who created God is, I mean, it's just a non-question. I don't quite know, I can't think right at the moment of an equivalent that would explain it. So let's conclude over in, I mean, I have a couple more scriptures, but I'm out of time. John chapter 16. John chapter 14. Excuse me, I misspoke. John chapter 14. Here we have the famous encounter by Thomas. And poor Thomas, I mean, he gets such a bad rap. You have him slated. I don't know if it's because he was the guy that asked the first question, but if you read the account here, all the other disciples ask similar questions. I don't know why Thomas gets the bad rap for being doubting Thomas, because there was doubting Philip and doubting Peter and whoever else spoke here as well. But verse 5, I'm glad he asked the question. He said, Thomas said to him, Lord, we do not know where you are going, and how can we know the way? Jesus said to him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one can come to the Father except through me. So while no one can come to Christ except through the Father, I mean, the reverse is also true. One final scripture in John chapter 11, verse 25. John chapter 11. Verse 21, then Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died, but even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Note that he didn't say that he was in heaven, which is interesting. He said he will rise again. And Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. And Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live. Jesus incarnate claimed what he would become and was able to bring back to life even then, as he will do in the future. So when you ask yourself this question, you know, what is? I mean, those are questions that, you know, scientists ask, you know, what is the source of life? We ask two questions at the beginning. Is light a source of life? I mean, the answer is yes. I mean, in many different respects as we surveyed today. But when you get to the second question, and you make it definitive, I mean, it's amazing what an indefinite and definite article can do to a question. When you get to the second question and you make it definitive and ask the question, is light the source of life? It is a resounding no. It is not the definitive, ultimate source of life, because as Jesus said, he is the resurrection and the life.